Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now, Susan Glasser, who writes the New Yorker magazine's column, Letter from Trump's Washington. She's also author of the book Covering Politics in a Post-Truth America and co-author of Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin and the End of Revolution, and Ilya Meretz from WNYC. You've heard of WNYC. He's co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast. Hi, Susan. Hi, Ilya.
Hi, Brian.
Hi there.
So, Susan, among the many things that this report is, without saying so explicitly, it's a magnificent affirmation of the accuracy of our leading news organizations. And I just wanted to start with that, because so much of what's in there, confirmed by the government, are stories that the New York Times and Washington Post and Wall Street Journal and New Yorker and others reported along the way, often having to keep their sources unnamed, but that Trump casually and repeatedly smeared as fake news. The Trump Tower meeting was real, and I could go on and on and on and on. I wonder if you've been thinking about that.
Absolutely, and I really appreciate you saying that, because I think it is an important point to make. You're talking about a situation that's so, you know, really unprecedented, where the President of the United States has waged essentially a concerted campaign against the news media. What comes across in this report is also the extent to which, behind the scenes, he's so media-driven. It's not even that he is casually dismissing or spinning things. This is a purposeful effort both to cover up facts, to get others who worked for him to lie about things he knew not to be true, to lie himself about things he knew not to be true. And then when journalists reported stories nonetheless, accurately, that said things he didn't want to hear, going public and accusing them of fake news.
Listeners, our phones are open with Susan Glasser and Ilya Meretz. Broadly on the Mueller report, have you been reading any of it yourself, or even if you've just been consuming news organizations' coverage of it, anything you want to say, or particularly if you want to ask our guests who've been reading a lot of it very closely, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Susan, your article keys on Mueller findings about Trump's willingness to lie constantly, even in high-stakes situations. And you give the example of the night that Trump invited James Comey to dinner to ask him for loyalty to Trump rather than to the law. Can you describe that part of the Mueller report and why you put that in your article today?
Well, thank you, Brian. You know, it's funny. That's an example, it seems to me, of two things. One, we already know this, obviously. It's not a surprise that, the guy who's gotten more Pinocchios than anyone ever, is not representing things truthfully. But his willingness to misrepresent both high stakes, big things, and little things is what is mind-blowing. And also the extent to which the Mueller team went to actually prove that even those little things were lies is quite striking to me. So James Comey, it's one of the most important moments in this potential obstruction narrative, right? When the president invites his FBI director to dinner and early in his administration and essentially demands a loyalty pledge from him, Comey is alarmed. That begins to set this chain of events in motion. Well, Trump even later not only said he barely even knew James Comey, but he specifically said untruthfully in public about this dinner, well, I don't even know. I think he asked to come see me, as opposed to just acknowledging he invited him to dinner. Well, Mueller, footnote shows that he had two sources for this, the sworn testimony of Trump's first chief of staff, Reince Priebus, and the president's official schedule, which they went and got, which shows not only that Comey came to dinner, but specifically that an invitation was extended to him on January 27, 2017.
Ilya, you've done reporting for Trump Inc. on the Trump Tower Moscow deal, among many other things, but the Trump Tower Moscow deal that was being negotiated through the campaign and that Trump kept secret from the public and Michael Cohen got caught lying to Congress about. And Mueller goes into quite some detail about that. Was this in the collusion volume or the obstruction volume?
This was in the collusion volume. And just a bit of context here. Trump Tower Moscow is particularly interesting to us precisely because Mueller doesn't have so very much to say about the Trump Organization business. You will recall over the past 2 years, there's been speculation that he would be looking closely at Trump's Deutsche Bank loans or that Mueller would obtain Trump's tax returns. If those things happened, they're not mentioned here. So I think the meatiest section that we have about Trump's business and by extension, Trump's conflict of interest, both as a candidate and then on taking office, is about the Trump Tower Moscow. And what's so endlessly fascinating about this project is it was taking off at precisely the time that candidate Trump took off. You will recall when Trump declared in 2015, I believe it was June, it was seen as a little bit of a joke thing. And in fact, the Huffington Post decided to cover his candidacy in their news section, but I think like the lifestyle section or something like that. But Trump, from early days and all the way through, Donald Trump dominated the polls. And as he was dominating those polls, he was also pursuing deals in Russia and getting noticed, it turns out, we learned here, from people who wanted to make connections, from people in Russia who wanted to make connections with Trump.
In fact, Mueller takes this story back to before Trump was a candidate and ties it into Trump and Michael Cohen's interest in getting a meeting with Putin way back to like 2014, right?
Right. So 2013 is the year that the Miss Universe pageant happened in Moscow, and Donald Trump flew in. He owned the Miss Universe pageant. And his partners for that effort were the Agalarov family, which owned a development in Moscow, still own, called Crocus City. And they hosted it at Crocus City. Around that time, shortly thereafter, Trump Organization started talking with the Agalarovs about building a Trump Tower Moscow. This is the fourth effort that we know that Trump made to build a tower in Moscow, going all the way back to the late 1980s. That seems to have stalled sometime in 2014. Mueller doesn't really tell us why, but then the thread picks up again in 2015 with a different developer named Andrei Rozov. And Rozov is a guy that we spent a lot of time looking at closely for our recent episode of Trump Inc., precisely because, unlike the Agalarovs and unlike some of Trump's other partners, actually like some of Trump's other partners, I should probably say, Rozov doesn't have a particularly impressive record as a developer. If you were going to be doing a project in Russia, which itself is a questionable thing to do because around that time Russia invaded Ukraine and there were a lot of leading banks were sanctioned, you'd think you would go with a totally tried and true developer, and that's not what this guy Andrei Rozov was.
So, Susan, as you read, if you've read that portion of the Mueller report, was Trump compromised by this? I mean, Putin knew Trump was keeping a secret from the American people during the whole campaign about a conflict of interest with Russia while he was out there saying nice things about Putin.
Well, that's right, Brian. In fact, I've always thought that was very significant since Michael Cohen turned on Trump and we gave public testimony saying that the president had lied throughout the 2016 campaign and said he had no ongoing deals in Russia at the same time that Michael Cohen was pursuing this deal in his path. And not only that, but actually seeking the Kremlin's help. So it's not just that Putin knew that Trump wasn't telling the truth. He knew that his organization, that Trump's business, was seeking Kremlin help, which, by the way, is not what you would do if this was an up-and-up project, any more than you would ask Barack Obama to help you build an office building here in Washington, D.C. It's, you know, this in and of itself, it seems to me, is a very questionable outreach. Number one. Number two, yes, of course, it's compromise. And any time there's a gap between what you're saying publicly and privately, that's something that intelligence agencies can exploit. But it does go to the question about the Mueller report that I had at the end of the day. Obviously, part two is this obstruction narrative. It offers a very disturbing portrait of what was going on at the White House and the president's own efforts to try to shut down the investigation into him. I came away from part one feeling much less satisfied, especially someone who spent a lot of time reporting in Russia and thinking about this, there are all these data points that are out there. In fact, a report adds a few new ones to them about the Trump campaign and its dealings with Russia and Russians. And yet it doesn't put them together. And, you know, we still haven't had anyone to stitch this narrative together for us. We don't know what these data points mean.
And that was the most interesting part for me of your article today, because you concede that even being a Russia expert, Putin book author, former Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, you don't know anything more than you did before the report came out yesterday about why Trump has such a strange affection for Putin, or what to make of the Trump campaign's apparent advanced knowledge of the hacked emails. So on Trump's affection for Putin, have you become convinced that Trump really wasn't compromised, that is, vulnerable to blackmail by him in some way, and it was about that? I mean, maybe it's worse to think that he just really believes in Putinism and breaking up our historic closeness with Western Europe, which I thought only Putin would seem to benefit from. I mean, how do you put it together?
Well, these are good and not easy to answer questions, and I think that's part of the problem. We Americans can tend to be, frankly, quite simplistic in our views of things, and especially because we live in a very rule of law society. And so, you know, is it a crime or isn't it? Doesn't really help us to explain this fact that we don't have a way of understanding and connecting the dots here, because it's, you know, life isn't just everybody is 100% good or they're 100% bad. And that's just not how it works. And I think that's the problem for us in interpreting this. Was there a convergence of interests somehow that we still don't understand between Trump and Putin? Yes, quite possibly. Is it also true that Trump seems to have a public affinity for authoritarian leaders and strongmen of all kinds? Yes, absolutely. That's not limited to Vladimir Putin. Look at how he sucks up to Kim Jong-un. Look at how he seems to admire Erdogan in Turkey, or even Xi Jinping in China, right? So is that a part of it?
Susan, Ilya here, I have a question for you based on sort of my close reading of this Trump Tower Moscow stuff. And the part that was really surprising to me is realizing that a bunch of well-connected Russians were also reaching out to people in the Trump organization around that time, sort of suggesting that that word was traveling around just kind of top circles in Moscow that that Trump wanted to build there. And it kind of raised this interesting possibility that I hadn't really thought about before, which is that similar to the self-interested people that the Trump campaign, Americans that the Trump campaign seems to have attracted, maybe there was a similar class of people in Russia who kind of thought that they could make a thing happen and also kind of raise their own standing in Moscow. For having reported there, is that how you read these multiple efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really helpful insight. And, you know, again, the difference being that it's not just kind of, you know, bottom feeding hangers on, but it's really not possible to flourish at the upper levels of Russian business without having, you know, the approval and close connections with the upper levels of the Russian government and the Kremlin, because of the complete fusion, essentially, between the oligarchy and the political oligarchy that runs the country. So it's just much more closely tied and under the control and connected to the upper levels of the Russian government. But yes, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, again, remember also Paul Manafort, a known quantity to Russian oligarchs, Russian figures like Oleg Deripaska, people in the Kremlin. And so the fact that Trump was out there saying these lavishly praising things about Vladimir Putin and Russia on the campaign trail, that he hired this pro-Russian consultant to be his campaign chairman, that's sending a very strong message. So maybe it's business, maybe it's politics, maybe it's a mix of both. That's what they do in Russia, is they mix money and politics at the top level. So I think it all sends a lot of a signal. And just because it doesn't fit into the relatively narrow frame of, you know, is there a crime under this provision of the federal statute or not here in the United States, doesn't mean that these aren't questionable connections, and ones that are very relevant for the president of the United States to be carrying with him into the Oval Office.
Ron in Boston, you're on WNYC with Susan Glasser from The New Yorker and our Trumping podcast co-host Ilya Meritz. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I very much want to echo what you just concluded with, Lisa Glasser. I felt very frustrated since the report has come out. I just actually saw Senator Ben Cardin on TV saying they couldn't prove conspiracy. He said they couldn't prove collusion, and therefore there was no collusion crime indictment to follow. That's expressly not what the Mueller report says. I think it's page 2 makes it clear that essentially collusion has been demonstrated. Collusion is a proven fact. The conspiracy, which requires all the aspects of law, as you were indicating, that is something that has not been able to be demonstrated, or perhaps he didn't even try because of the Justice Department position on indicting a president. But I really wish Democrats and truth tellers in the public would frame the conversation in that way. In fact, the Mueller report confirms and gives express evidence for the fact that collusion at the highest level for all sorts of self-interested reasons took place. And that reality is the one which the president has successfully undermined in the public perception, I think, with tweets and bumper stickers.
Susan,
I know
you got to go in a minute. What do you say to Ron?
You know, I appreciate his insights here. I think it is very important, the language that was used in the report. They specifically said, and this is a, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is this is a very specific prosecutorial term. They did not establish the existence of a conspiracy that would rise to the level of charging. And they also said that they did not disprove that either, and that they would say so if they did. Same thing on the obstruction. It wasn't only that they weren't exonerating him, but that they would say so if they did. And, of course, that is what was so misleading, it seems to me, about Attorney General Barr's presentation of this report for the last 4 weeks. It was 4 weeks ago today that this report was delivered to the Justice Department, 4 weeks in which essentially the Trump administration was allowed to mischaracterize it. And I think that is something that we're certainly going to remember, that history is going to remember about the treatment of this report. It does seem to be a case study in more or less successful political management and spin of what is a pretty damaging investigatory work product here.
Susan Glasser writes the Letter from Trump's Washington column in The New Yorker, and she has a piece today on the Mueller report on The New Yorker website. Susan, thanks so much for some time.
Brian, thank you so much.
And we have a few minutes left with Ilya Meretz from Trump Inc. and Jerome in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Gerald Nadler, by the way, including the news he's making this morning about a new post-Mueller report subpoena, will be coming up in 5 minutes. Jerome in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. When James Comey held a press conference to declare Hillary Clinton not guilty, he went on to enumerate a number of bad judgment calls, lack of character and so forth. And he was severely criticized and even, I think, cited by Rosenstein in the letter which led to his firing. And now William Barr goes on television to present the results of the Mueller report, and then he goes on in the opposite direction, giving all sorts of reasons for Trump behaving in the way that he did. And I know he's being criticized, but I just wanted, and one's the Attorney General and the other's the FBI head. I don't know how that plays into it, but it's just very striking to me.
Jerome, thank you very much. Ilya, it is certainly striking, and some news organizations on television have been playing clips of attorneys general from back in the Watergate era, where they were much more even-handed and they were looking at this nuance of evidence and that nuance of evidence. And Barr came out yesterday, as we know, and even Chris Wallace on Fox News said he's acting almost like Trump's defense counsel.
Barr is such an interesting figure. I watched with everyone else yesterday as he was making his remarks, and the thing that just made me sit up straight in my seat was when he started characterizing Donald Trump's own feelings on taking office and what it must be like to be an incoming president and know that you've already been the target of an investigation for a long time and feeling that you won't be able to carry out your duties in office. It just seemed to, it seemed like it must stray from the script. In fact, we saw his prepared remarks later. It was in his prepared remarks. The other thing that is so interesting to me about William Barr is he was an attorney general before for George H.W. Bush, I believe. And
at which time he wrote a report called The Case for More Incarceration. And now he's attorney general again.
He's also a longtime believer in expansive executive power. But he's an example of, you know, we hear so much about Trump breaking the Washington establishment, but there's also a part of the Washington establishment that is comfortable working with Trump. And William Barr, I think a lot of senators were probably comfortable voting for his confirmation precisely because he had done the job before. And even among Democrats who might disagree with him politically, he was a known quantity and seen as sort of a trusted hand kind of person. I wonder after yesterday's performance and his letter a month ago, if people still feel that way.
And there's certainly more to come on that, because it seems like William Barr is choosing to go down in history as having gone full Trump at this late point in his career. WNYC's Ilya Meritz, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast. You have a special post-Mueller edition coming out or out?
Yes, refresh your feeds this afternoon. We'll be out momentarily, and it's a good one.
Thanks, Ilya. Congressman Nadler joins us in a minute.